Well, thank you everyone for coming today and welcome to the Parliamentary Library's 2010 Understanding the Budget Seminar. Each year, the Library provides clients with a suite of specialist services and products centred on the budget. And the budgets are very complex beasts, and this year it is made even more complex by the full implementation of the Operation Sunlight Effects. And I know even in the Department of Parliamentary Services preparing our portfolio budget statements that sometimes it's looked incomprehensible to me compared to last year's. In addition to today's seminar, we'll also provide the budget review publication and the opinion and analysis of the budget in the media page. And both of those can be found on the Library's website, and you have a little flyer to take away with you that has the URLs of the opinions and analysis of the budget, which of course will be up tomorrow. And then we will offer the budget review paper as it is developed. Whilst the negative effect of the global financial crisis on the Australian economy was less than was predicted at this point in time, the remaining uncertainty in the world economy, for example, the current problems in Greece and other European Union countries, and the slow recovery in the USA, is an indication that the world has not fully recovered from the global financial crisis. This precarious economic environment is challenging government policymakers around the globe, and the Australian government is facing similar issues in this final budget for the 42nd Parliament. To assist you with understanding basic budget concepts, reading of main tables and recent changes, I will hand you over to our macroeconomic specialist, Scott Compo-Harms, who will take you through the very significant changes to budget forecasts and projections and the key tables in budget paper number one that reveal the government's view of the economy. Following Scott, we have Garth Day, who will examine the budget in the context of the fiscal strategy. Garth, we're very lucky to have. He's on loan to us from the Treasury and is also a PhD candidate at the ANU. Our resident budget expert, Richard Webb, who has seen too many budgets to count, will then take you through key budget concepts and terms and guide you through the budget papers that contain the most relevant information. So the presentations today will give you a very important overview and will be available on the web shortly, including the slides and the audio version of this. And our experts will be awaiting your inquiries as things progress this week. Thank you very much.
Scott.
Okay, thank you, Roxanne. I'd like to thank you all for turning up today to what I hope is an interesting perspective on the Commonwealth Budget, due to be delivered by the Treasurer, the Honourable Wayne Swan, at 7:30pm tonight. The topic of my presentation is called The Macroeconomics of the Budget. Macroeconomics is all about the relationships between economic aggregates, usually at a national level, such as real gross domestic product, household final consumption expenditure, business investment, etc. The Commonwealth Budget contains some aggregates which are also related to the economy. These include the budget deficit or surplus, of which there are a number of figures, total revenue collected, total expenditure, and balance sheet measures such as net debt and net worth. The budget also contains information on forecasts and projections for the domestic economy over the forward estimates period, or 4 years following the current financial year, as well as historical data and other information which may be of interest to you. Given that fiscal stimulus is still a topical issue in all advanced economies, I thought I would briefly describe what fiscal policy is and the different ways that it can be implemented as part of the overall budget process. Fiscal policy can simply be defined as the use of the government's policy settings in relation to the budget. The fiscal policy levers are revenue settings, and these are things like introducing or removing taxes, changing tax rates, or forgoing revenue for certain classes of constituents. There is also expenditure measures and also the purchase or sale of financial or non-financial assets. The other main macroeconomic policy lever is monetary policy, which is the domain of the central bank, the Reserve Bank of Australia in Australia's case. I discuss the overlap between fiscal and monetary policy later on. I will concentrate on budget paper number one, whilst Richard Webb will have some additional comments on parts of budget paper number one also. You should have a couple of handouts. There is one which contains a range of tables from budget paper number one, and I will refer to tables presented in the handout, so please make sure you have a copy of that. And you'll also have a copy of the slideshow as well, or at least my part of it. Budget paper number one is divided into a series of statements. Most of these statements are regular parts of the budget and are included under the same headings each year. However, there is usually one statement, usually number four, that focuses on a specific issue of interest to the government. The topic is usually related to a policy issue being addressed in the budget. For example, in recent years, we've seen statements covering labour force participation, productivity, and fiscal sustainability. I won't mention anything more about the special statements here. I will restrict the rest of my talk to the regular statements that appear each year. Having said that, it is entirely up to the government as to lay out the budget and what is included. Thus, we could all find out at 7:30 p.m. that everything you've been told today is wrong and utterly useless. But let's proceed on the basis that that won't happen. The structure of budget paper number one is as follows. I will be covering information from statements 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 and 10. Richard will also have something to say about statements 5, 6 and 10, among other topics. In statement 1, a brief summary of the budget is presented in table 1, along with some broad aggregates that underlie the budget in table 2. This is the place to go if you just want to find headline figures, such as the budget surplus or deficit, and key domestic economic forecasts or projections. The performance of the economy is a crucial determinant of actual budget outcomes, and the budget can also have an impact on the economy. As a brief example, if the unemployment rate rises due to a decline in economic activity, we would expect to observe falling revenue into the future from lower income tax, company tax, and GST receipts. This would be accompanied by a rise in expenditure on unemployment benefits and labour market assistance, among other things. Thus, without even changing the settings of the budget at all, it is possible for the actual budget outcome to differ markedly from the published figures. Thus, it is important to remember that the budget is just a statement of the government's expectations of the future. The forecasts and projections are not actual observations, but merely what the government expects to happen, given their view of the economic outlook and any recent previously unbudgeted policy decisions. More intuitively, deliberate policy changes introduced in the budget can also have an impact on the broader economy. There are many examples: new taxes, changes to existing taxes, new spending programs, etc. With the mooted resources super profits tax, it will no doubt make it more difficult for Treasury to forecast total revenue accurately, as no one is really sure how the new tax will affect behaviour in the mining sector and how any structural changes to the economy may affect other revenue sources. Statement 2 deals with the more detailed forecasts and projections for key economic aggregates, given projections for and assumptions made regarding what are known as exogenous variables, or variables whose values are determined outside the system. So-called exogenous variables are things like the economic growth of trading partners, the exchange rate, crude oil prices, etc. These assumptions and projections are fed into Treasury's TRIM model of the economy, which is then used to compute forecast values for things like real gross domestic product, interest rates, household consumption, business investment, etc. Table number one in statement two shows the domestic economy forecasts. Prior to 2009-10, there was only one year forecast beyond the budget year. In the 2009-10 budget, the government introduced a new forecasting methodology and presented forecasts out for 2 years beyond the budget year. It remains to be seen whether the new methodology will be applied again or if the government will revert to previous practice. This table also includes notes regarding assumptions made about oil prices, the trade-weighted index, which is an index of Australian dollar exchange rates weighted according to our trade flows, and the future path of interest rates. The forecasts used in Table 1 can be compared with actual observations from Australian Bureau of Statistics publications. I should also mention as an aside that monthly financial statements are available from the Department of Finance and Deregulation website. They provide a monthly update of the progress of revenue, expenditure and the budget deficit surplus as funds are spent throughout the year. In around September, the government will also publish the final budget outcome document for the previous year. I will not go into more detail here, but if you would like assistance with tracking the progress of budget forecasts as actual observations become available, then please contact me and my details will be made available at the end. Table 2 in statement number 2 shows international economic forecasts, which are used to produce the domestic forecasts. These are sourced from the IMF and national statistical agencies. These variables are exogenous or taken as given. Statement 3 contains information on the budget aggregates, that is, in simple terms, the bottom line. However, there are a few different bottom lines, and I will now go through some of these. The two main bottom lines are the cash balance and the fiscal balance. The cash balance is also expressed in what is known as headline and underlying terms. Cash balances are based on cash accounting, whereas the fiscal balance is based on accrual accounting. Cash accounting standards mean that transactions are recorded as they actually happen, whereas accrual accounting means that transactions are recorded once they are accrued. For example, under cash accounting, superannuation entitlements for public servants are only recorded once the entitlements are actually paid out to the beneficiary, whereas under accrual accounting, the entitlements are recorded as soon as they are accrued by each public servant, even though they may not be paid out for a number of years. The distinction between headline and underlying cash balances is that the underlying balance is merely the headline balance minus any unusual items, such as the receipt of proceeds from a privatisation or the earnings of the future fund. Table 3 in Statement 3 contains estimates and projections for these three balances. Which balance is most relevant to you? Well, if you are interested in short-term aspects of the effects of changes in the budget, such as fiscal stimulus spending, then the underlying cash balance is more likely to reflect the impact of the budget as it tracks when money is actually spent or received. On the other hand, the fiscal balance looks at changes to the budget as they accrue, and so this form of accounting is more suited to long-term analysis, such as that contained in the intergenerational reports. Tables 5 and 6 in Statement 3 are quite interesting. These tables reconcile the previous budget and the current budget, including any budget updates that have been issued in the meantime. Any variations in the relevant budget balance are decomposed in these tables into two categories: policy decisions and parameter and other variations. The first category refers to deliberate policy choices by the government that have altered the budget, whereas the second category refers to changes in the budget that have arisen due to unforeseen circumstances, such as better or worse than forecast real GDP growth, for example. These tables are where you want to go to see, for example, if any spending targets have been met through deliberate policy decisions or through parameter and other variations. Essentially, these can be likened to manna from heaven. They are unexpected windfall gains or losses. These reconciliation tables are available for revenue and expenditure separately in both cash and accrual terms in Statements 5 and 6 also. Table 7 in Statement 3 looks at balance sheet measures such as net debt, net worth and net financial worth, as well as net interest payments. In Appendix A, there are also a few interesting tables that show the sensitivity of the budget's economic and fiscal forecasts to a couple of selected scenarios. There were two scenarios considered last year. The scenarios consider what would happen to real and nominal GDP, as well as other economic forecasts, if certain external shocks were to hit the economy. This economic impact is then used to estimate the impact on the budget. Statements 5 and 6, they both deal with revenue and expenses and net capital investment. In these statements, you can find totals as well as the reconciliation tables that I've already mentioned. There are lots more interesting and useful tables contained in these statements, particularly on different sources of revenue, expenditure by portfolio, and public service staffing levels. Richard Webb will also mention some other useful information contained in these statements. I will just re-emphasise that the introduction of a new tax will make it hard to make it more difficult than usual, at least for the next few years, for Treasury to accurately forecast revenue, as they do not know for sure exactly how the economy will react to any new tax. Statement 7 presents an outline of the developments on the General Government balance sheet, items such as net debt, net worth, and net financial worth. I discuss these a little bit more further on, but at this point, I should clarify what I mean when I talk about the general government sector, or GGS. The total public sector is divided into three sectors: the general government sector, or GGS, public financial corporations, or PFCs, and public non-financial corporations, or PNFCs. The general government sector and public non-financial corporations make up what is known as the non-financial public sector. The general government sector is made up of all government departments that provide non-market goods and services and are funded through the Treasury. Public non-financial corporations are corporations that provide goods and services, usually on a commercial basis, and are largely funded through their own activities. Public financial corporations include the Reserve Bank of Australia and other authorities that can borrow on the government's behalf. So Statement 7 only presents an outline of the general government sector balance sheet, so it is only a small part of the total public sector. Statement 8 is known as the Statement of Risks. This is where the government lays out the major risks to the budget, either favourable or unfavourable. These are where so-called contingent assets and liabilities are listed. These are assets or liabilities that will only materialise contingent upon some event, such as a default on guaranteed debt. A real-world example of a contingent liability arose from... arose from the government's financial sector guarantees. Basically, contingent liabilities do not show up on the government's budget balance or on the balance sheet. They only show up in the event of, say, a default on guaranteed debt. So they do not appear in the budget balance. They are separated into quantifiable and unquantifiable assets and liabilities. The real-world example is the Commonwealth Financial Claims Scheme, other financial guarantees to the banks and the states. You may not be able to get an estimate, though, of what the government is actually on the hook for. Statement number 9 deals with 9 budgeted financial statements. These are the cash flow statements, operating statements, and balance sheets for the 2 main sectors of government. These financial statements are produced on a comparable basis to states and territories, and this is the Uniform Presentation Framework, or UPF. These are used as inputs into the ABS government finance statistics, but these are not normally published in a very timely fashion, so you're better off going to the budget documents to find them. And in here you can find forecasts and projections for both net and gross debt in all of those 3 government sectors. I won't say very much about statement number 10, except to say that it contains a lot of historical data, and you can find it for receipts, expenses, net interest payments, etc. So if you're looking for stuff back in time, that's the place to go. I'd just like to make some quick additional comments. Firstly, the overlap between fiscal and monetary policy. In Australia, the government, in response to the freezing up of the securitisation market, announced the purchase of up to $16 billion worth of residential mortgage-backed securities to keep lending flowing in the residential mortgage market. That was seen as an act of fiscal policy because that was taken onto the general government sector balance sheet through the Australian Office of Financial Management. In the United States, the same action was done, but it was taken by the US Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, and so therefore that was considered an unconventional monetary policy act. The moral of the story is there's more than one way to skin a cat. The other point I'd like to make is about the solvency of the public sector. Measures such as net debt and net worth, net financial worth, these are all private sector accounting concepts. And so they don't necessarily apply to the government in the same way, because the government has a major advantage over the private sector, and that is that they have a monopoly over the issue of currency. And so therefore, the government always has an option. If it chooses, it wants to continue funding activities, it can decide to issue more of its own currency and can issue that in exchange for real goods and services. So therefore, the public sector can never technically go insolvent. I'm not saying that this is a good idea. However, you cannot have an insolvent public sector as such, especially if you have a flexible exchange rate. If you have a fixed exchange rate, it's a different kettle of fish, and this is the heart of Greece's problems at the moment. But I'll leave it at that. And I'd like to re-emphasise again, the budget is a statement of the government's expectations. It's not a statement of fact. A lot of the figures that you'll see in the budget may never be realised. The net debt figures may never be accumulated. So just keep in mind that it is a statement of expectations. It will be revised. And so, I'll leave it at that. Okay, thank you very much.
I think that's a good point that Scott finishes up on there. Debt can certainly be ameliorated by government through printing of money. However, if it needs to be in good shape, it needs to be unexpected, it needs to be over a longer period of time. Obviously, the best way to, and most conventional way, is to get the budget in a reasonable shape, and that can be quite difficult. As you've been watching the news recently, a country such as Greece is facing difficulty in trying to do significant changes over a short period of time. If an economy government is in good shape, changes can be made in a reasonable fashion over a medium term to get to your destination without too much structural difficulties. So today I'm going to talk about that longer term view of things. I suppose the government sector, when I was speaking to a number of people, has been likened to, say, a ship at sea. And I sort of think about it like an oil tanker. Firstly, storms can buffet it, but it generally remains intact. Secondly, once underway, gathering significant memento, it's very hard to change course quickly. And thirdly, if it does go off course and hits a reef, the consequences of that can be quite devastating. So that's how a number of people probably have view the government sector as quite a large ship on its course. And it's very hard to change it quickly. Things are usually changed at the margin. When I'm getting my hair cut, as you all do, you have a chat about what's happening. The focus is usually on the current circumstances, the short-run impacts on the economy. It just so happens that my hairdresser seems to know more about what's going on with the budget than some of the people I speak to around here. Last year, where was it? 2008, 2009, 2010, this is the year that we're currently still in. This is what happened last year. And I suppose you'd want to sort of break this up and say, well, okay, this is the 2008-9. 2007-8, the Rudd government came into power late 2007. So is this budget the Rudd part of the Rudd government? Well, some may say not. So in some ways, the current government came into power in difficult circumstances within a short period of time. The marked change occurred, as explained to me by my hairdresser, in the sense of Department of Finance people were running around like chooks with their heads dropped off trying to get money out the door last year, and this year they've been working for months on end trying to make things a little more sustainable over the longer term, reduce the deficits over the longer term, and the media reports seem to suggest that we might actually have a surplus a little bit earlier than expected. These sort of changes to the budget are more term structural. The question is how much of these deficits is cyclical as a result of the downturn, and how much of it is a structural weakening of the budget, either through decisions made by the government, building programs over the long term, or a terms of trade effect, weakening growth from China. There's obviously been a bounce back in China midway through last year, and there's concerns that their growth will weaken somewhat, but long term, the expectation is that China's growth, as along with other countries, India and so forth in the region, will provide a structural improvement to our economy and therefore the underlying budget. When we look at, from an economist's point of view, the budget balance, we can split it up into structural and cyclical effects. The reason I've got the P there is we're talking about the primary budget balance, and that is extracting interest payments. And we'll get to that point a little bit later, but it might very well just be B, being the budget is split between structural and cyclical factors. I'm just alluding you to the fact of other definitions here of the budget, principally the primary budget balance, and we'll talk about that a little later. I suppose it's to do the bottom line of it, it's to do with the optimal level of debt that is sustainable, and in Australia's case we may be looking at not debt but positive net assets. And the reason for that, and the reason that a resource tax may be mooted and put into place, and that revenue put into a sovereign wealth fund or whatever it might be termed, and that money sent overseas, is to offset the increase in the exchange rate from that terms of trade boom that we've been experiencing, and therefore achieve balanced growth across the whole economy, and not just a bias toward resource companies and companies that are linked to that. It's avoiding what is termed the resource curse. Effectively, as I've mentioned, the structural component of the budget is driven by policy measures in the main, and that's termed discretionary fiscal policy. Structural changes, as I've alluded to as well, is if there's a change in the longer term growth profile of the economy, the budget will benefit there, so there's structural benefits on that side as well. Cyclical factors that impact the budget come from shocks to economic activity, but how do they hit the budget? They hit the budget through, let's say, a negative shock, reduced income taxes, reduced company taxes. Indirect taxes are less sensitive. Increase in social security and welfare payments are the general mechanism. However, these are only a portion of the whole revenue side of things, and this is only a reasonable portion of the expenditure side of things. So in aggregate, things aren't as volatile as these components. The reason I'm just sort of giving a bit of a background to some of those terms and so forth is to think about it in the context of the government's fiscal strategy. When the government came to office, This is what was put up in the 2008-09 budget. Number one, achieving a budget surplus on average over the economic cycle. Number two, keeping taxation as a share of GDP on average below the level of, below the level for 2007-08. Effectively, what that means in conjunction with the first point is that expenditure will be less than revenue as a percentage of GDP on average over the cycle. The third point, improving the government's net financial worth over the medium term. So that sort of generally follows from the fact, well, if you're running surpluses, you'd effectively be adding to your wealth. And so that seems straightforward. However, the issue comes into play of, well, interest, let's say you've got net positive assets, does the interest on that constitute adding to net wealth? Does interest payments on that those assets, which mean that you may be running a surplus, constitute a surplus? That's why, from an economist's point of view, when we're looking at sustainability of the budget, we extract from interest repayments, because that's not necessarily what we want to look at, because $1 in the bank or $1 billion in the bank earning interest is not necessarily what some people may consider improving net financial worth, but it would actually tick off on these sort of things. So there is room to improve on this, and the government actually is open to that. I think it's made good steps from the previous government, and we'll touch on that. This is the changes made to the fiscal strategy last year, suggesting that the government will hold growth in spending to 2% a year until the budget returns to surplus. And another statement in the budget papers is that it will hold real growth in spending below 2% in the years the economy is projected to grow above trend. So a few terms there. Above trend in the out years, you'd expect that to occur. However, in the budget papers, there is a revision back to trend in the out years. So one may expect that, according to this, growth above 2% is possible in the out years when growth reverts back to trend. And that's just a concept associated with the forecasts. The previous government fiscal strategy was effectively to balance the budget over the cycle. And in terms of this structural concept, you're effectively, on average, targeting a cyclically adjusted budget balance of zero. As it turned out, the government was achieving a structural surplus in above 1% of GDP. That's extracting from the cycle. So traditionally, the government hasn't published estimates of the underlying structural balance, but as I noticed with pointed out with that first chart, that's what the government is pointing to these days and trying to be a little more transparent, which is a good thing, noting that it's worthwhile to assess the budget, how the budget's driven by these different factors. And effectively, whether the government prints these things in the budget papers or not, they need to know, as I say, implicitly or explicitly, whether the budget will be in an underlying structural surplus or deficit. And when framing the budget, the last budget, I will probably just dive into an example. In fact, this is as a result of the financial crisis, the government ran a structural deficit in the short period to provide stimulus. So they had to make sure that they cut enough. They're not just running a deficit that's driven by cyclical factors. They need to run a deficit that is driven by policy decisions, building programs, tax deductions brought forward, once-off payments and so forth, that provide stimulus and are a structural change to the budget. Conversely to that, they need to make decisions down the track to bring the structural balance back up out of deficit as the economy recovers. And this is the medium-term target here, is requiring a structural surplus. This is just an example that you can draw from the budget tables, and this shows how cyclical some of these particular revenue heads there, for example, are. Individual tax drops slightly, 0.5%, company tax down 10%, petroleum resource tax down near 15%. In aggregate, the total decline in total revenue was 2.6%. Some specific expenditure programs increased considerably, once-off payments and so forth. Social Security and welfare up considerably. Overall, there was an increase by 15.8%. The issue there to bear in mind is that these things are generally growing over time, as you'd expect, and therefore any, even if they stayed the same, you know these things are growing below trend. So the only one that isn't increasing is the indirect tax base, which is decreasing effectively over time. This is a chart of the structural budget balance in the black line here, and we see that the structural balance has gone into deficit in 2008-09. A big chunk of that is obviously cyclical, as we pointed to. And the average across that period is around 1% if we go back through history. So the government needs to and will seek to, over the course of this budget and following budgets, to get the structural balance back to probably around the longer run average, which will be consistent with their fiscal strategy. This is actually just breaking that up into the structural and cyclical components in a little more detail, and we see that the change here of the government put into place is about 1.75 to a couple of percent of GDP of structural policy decisions that were made. There's about 3%, that plus that red component is the cyclical factor. So we can see how things are broken up as just an example to give you a bit of an idea of how these things work. This is actually just looking at the cyclical component by itself and saying, well, okay, this is actually during the last recession, starting in 1991-92, and what happened then on a cyclical basis, we had this, the red is income taxes deducting from the budget balance over that period for up to 5 or 6 years. This is 96-97, when it got back to a neutral position for the following government. However, one may consider the 91-92 recession as confined to that period. However, the impacts on the budget persisted for some time. And the government's alluded, the Treasurer has mentioned that indirect capital gains tax is going to detract from the budget. Company taxes have a lag. However, there's been some alluding to these sort of figures, that how much of a lag is going to be in these numbers and how long the downturn will persist. And a lot of it will depend on the rebound in China and how that impacts us. However, if we look at the impact of the early 1990s recession, we see that company taxes didn't kick in straight away, but they declined for a number of years. Certainly income taxes detracted from the budget for quite some time after a period where Social Security and Welfare, which is just the white squares, obviously had deteriorated for the first couple of years. Had stabilised, and then Social Security payments revert back to more of a neutral position. However, even though employment has regained some momentum, there's still a detraction in the budget on income taxes and company taxes. So this downturn isn't necessarily confined to a couple of years. It is long-lasting, and that's why we've got those deficits going out somewhat, although the government certainly will be looking to address that in this budget, as it seems. So we've gone over the fiscal strategy, what it is. What's the question sort of in everyone's mind, or certainly my mind, is what's the implicit target of these surpluses? We've got an estimate over the last 30 years that it's averaged about 1%. Is that what the government's going to go back to? Is it going to be more or less than that? And how will this budget seek to improve the structural balance over the medium term? Through policy decisions, and we've touched on a few points there. So thanks very much.
So if anyone has any questions for any of the three afterwards, we just ask you to get the microphone first, because otherwise your question won't be picked up in the microphone for the podcast.
Well, good morning. The purpose of my presentation is to help you to find information in the budget papers. There are four budget papers, these blue documents. In addition, I will go through a publication called the Portfolio Budget Statements. A portfolio consists of several agencies. I've actually chosen the Department of Resources to give you an idea what information you can find out about the budget of the Department of Resources. So I'll go immediately to budget paper number one, if I manage the technology. Sorry. Here we are. This is the summary page of budget paper number one. Scott and Garth talked about the first four statements in budget paper number one. I'll go immediately to the revenue statement. Okay. Sorry, what's happened? Sorry, this should have gone backwards somehow or other. I'm going worse and worse. Oh, that's the other way. That's it. Now we're getting it. Right, okay. Okay, here we are. That's all I want. Okay, statement number five is revenue. Okay. Statement number five is revenue. This is a summary table. It shows you all the sources of government revenue, taxation and non-taxation, broken down under the different headings. I'll just draw your attention to a few things that are worth mentioning. See under petroleum resource rent tax, just before the line income taxation revenue, I suspect that in this year's budget, we may see some estimates for the government's proposed resource rent tax in there. We're forever being asked, how much money does the government raise from excise duty on petrol and diesel? This is the place you can find it. As you probably know, the government has proposed increasing the excise on tobacco, so you'll probably see under the tobacco line there the additional increase in revenue from the result of the excise increase. Notice that last year they had the carbon pollution reduction scheme estimates in there. It'll be very interesting to see if they appear this year. I suspect they won't. But you can see the breakdown between total taxation revenue and the various sources of non-taxation revenue. One thing I should have mentioned further up at the top is goods and services tax. That's the total taxation revenue. So that's a very neat summary table of where you can find where is the government raising revenue from. There's much more detail in statement number five, but I won't go into that at this stage. Okay. Now, statement number six, we're still in budget paper number one. The government classifies its expenditure in different ways in different places. This, I think, is the most rational way that to help you understand what the what the government's spending its money on. Statement number six covers two things: expenses and a net capital investment. If your boss asks you how much is the government spending on education or health or whatever the case may be, this is the place to go. Last year, the one problem with this particular table on expenses, which is effectively the current expenses of the government, is that there are reclassifications of the items. What that means is that, strictly speaking, you may not be able to get a time series that is consistent. Last year, there was a major revision of many of the items that appeared under Social Security in particular. Consequently, the figures which come out for 2009-10 are, strictly speaking, not comparable with those of previous years. However, with a bit of luck, the budget for this year should be comparable, should give, provide you comparable figures in these particular areas. So you can see there that those are the broad categories of expenditure. I just should mention, in passing, other purposes. That's a very big item. The main reason that is big is it because it includes the goods and services tax, which is in the order of about $40 billion. In addition to that summary table, you will find breakdowns of the different categories of health. For example, I've just chosen health as this particular one, but for example, if you want to find how much does the government spend on non-government schools, you will find that sort of information in statement number six. Now, what I've dealt with here is so-called expenses. In addition, the government invests on its own behalf. It buys buildings and so on and so forth. The overall amount that the government invests on its own behalf is actually quite small compared to the total expenses. The biggest item of net capital investment is always defence. That is, if defence buys a battleship or aircraft carrier, whatever it may happen to be, you will find the estimates of the total amount of additional money that the government is providing for the Department of Defence in this particular section. One thing I should point out is that when I talk about government investment, the government actually funds a lot of investment. It doesn't actually invest all that much itself. The main way the government funds, provides investment is actually funding through the states. It provides grants to the states. Now, from the Commonwealth's perspective, this is not investment on its own behalf. Rather, it is a grant and therefore is treated as a payment to the states. And payments to the states, as I just mentioned, appear under other purposes. So bear in mind, when you're talking about government investment, we're only talking about the government itself buying buying buildings, land, whatever the case may be. It's a relatively small beer in the overall scheme of things. In other economic affairs, you'll find something called the contingency reserve. The contingency reserve is not a slush fund, as some people think. What the Department of Finance has found is that traditionally, agencies underestimate the amount they need to spend in future years. So the Department of Finance does a nice little fiddle, because what it does is, in the year after the budget, it takes the total expenses and adds another 2%. And in the year after that, it adds another 4%. Now, this doesn't sound terribly scientific, and the answer it isn't, but it does provide a better estimate of what total expenses will be in future years. Okay, that's statement number six. Oops, I've gone a bit too far now. Yep, statement number nine. Scott mentioned before there are three sectors of the government. The budget focuses on the thing called the general government sector, hence the title up at the top, general government sector. Okay. Now, this basically shows where all the revenue is coming in, what it's being spent on. There's a broad distinction between operating and non-operating. All the sections up at the top, revenue, expenses, and what have you, you end up with this thing called the net operating balance. And that's what the government focuses on. These other things called other economic flows are essentially non-operating activities. These are things which are essentially incidental to operating. So if, for example, people aren't paying their taxes, or students aren't repaying their HECS fees or something like that. They get written off as bad debts, or the government finds that its assets have been overvalued. That's where all these adjustments, these other economic flows, come through. In the main, you don't have to worry about it. Now, Scott mentioned there are two main measures of the budget deficit. One is the underlying cash balance. The other is the fiscal balance being the accrual measure of the budget deficit. Right down at the bottom, and so I'll have to try to scroll this up a little bit. Here we are. The fiscal balance is the sum of the operating balance and investment in non-financial assets. Non-financial assets are things such as land and buildings. The fiscal balance is derived by adding the net operating balance to the acquisition of for fiscal assets to create the fiscal balance. Sorry, I've gone too far. Sorry, my apologies, I've gone too far. Here we are, fiscal balance here, I'm sorry. So that's you will need to look at this particular statement for a variety of reasons. One is, I'll just draw your attention to a couple of items which you may need to look at. For example, if you look under expenses, you'll see something called interest expenses. As you know, the government is borrowing to finance its deficit. Therefore, you'll expect this category interest payment to increase over time. Now, the next slide is the balance sheet. This shows all the government's assets and liabilities. Assets are divided between financial assets. For example, all the money in the future fund appears under financial assets. The government's equity in the NBN, the National Broadcasting Network, the government's equity will appear under financial assets. It's not shown as a separate item, but it's classified as a financial asset. Another item which you may need to look at is government securities. As you can see, the government is borrowing substantially to fund its budget deficit, and you can see how that in last year it was projected that the amount outstanding of additional borrowings will be increasing fairly substantially. Another thing that you might need to look at is the superannuation liability. As you probably know, the future fund was established for the specific purpose of funding that particular liability, but you can see that the government owes us public servants a lot of money, I'm pleased to say. Another item down here, net debt. A lot of the discussion about fiscal policy is we've done a wonderful job in reducing debt, or how evil the government is in increasing net debt. Here's the item net debt, which you can see here as a memorandum item. I'll go now to statement number 10. Scott mentioned that we're often asked questions for what happened back in 1982-83. The reason I'm drawing this table to your attention is partly to save us from questions, but there's a lot of historical data in statement number 10. Budget deficit, a proportion of GDP. Net debt in another table. I haven't got it here. But if you want historical data, statement number 10 is the place to go. Okay, that's the end of budget paper number one. Budget paper number two is a paper which you will definitely have to encounter at some particular point of time. What budget paper number two contains is a list of all the measures that the government has introduced in the budget. Those measures which affect revenue, expenses, and capital items. You can see here that they're broken. This is a summary page, but the page references, you'll find details of the individual items, individual measures that the government has introduced in the budget. So this will be a very, very important budget paper for you. Bear in mind one important fact about budget paper number two. What budget paper number two does, it shows changes in expenses, revenue, and what have you. It does not show levels. So you cannot find from budget paper number two the amount that the government proposes to spend on a particular program. Sometimes you'll find negative figures. That can mean several things. One is that the government's decided to reduce expenditure on a particular item. In some cases, the negative figures simply mean all that the government has done is decided to take money out of a particular year and put it into another year. But you can see how it's set out very neatly. And, for example, under revenue measure, under Treasury, I expect this year you'll find the resource rent tax appearing there and also the tobacco excise. Under health and ageing, for example, I suspect you might find the additional funding that's been agreed under the new health agreement with the states. This is just an example of one particular expense measure, which shows you the agencies that are affected in this particular case, the Department of Agriculture and Centrelink, the financial years in which this particular policy measure will have some impact. Budget paper number three. Budget paper number three deals with payments to the states, territories, and local governments. The Commonwealth provides something like 45% of state revenues, so Commonwealth grants are extremely important. The grants that the Commonwealth provides to the states fall into two broad categories. One is payments for specific purposes, which is part two. Specific purpose payments are payments for things such as health, education, roads, and so on and so forth. In budget paper number three, you will find details of the programs which the Commonwealth is funding. So you'll find road funding there, you'll find the amount that's being paid to the states for hospitals. If budget paper number three follows previous year's formats, you will find payments over several years, and also by each state. So this is a very, very important document if you want to find out how much Queensland is getting for health grants. The second major component of government grants, Commonwealth grants to the states, is what are called general revenue assistance, sometimes called general purpose assistance. The main component of general revenue assistance is GST. So if you want to know how much GST the government is paying or expects to pay to New South Wales, that is the place to go. I won't go into budget paper number three anymore, and let's move on to budget paper number four. Budget paper number four, you will probably not use much at all. However, budget paper number four contains an introduction of 14 pages. I highly recommend that you read it, because what it does explains the process for appropriations. The alternative I might have is you can read my paper, which is 82 pages. It's a thing for 14, so it's not really a choice. But it's a very, very neat little summary and contains a lot of the jargon which you will have to face. I'm sorry. So I recommend reading Introduction to Budget Paper Number 4. The other thing, special appropriations and special accounts, that is basically information which is reproduced somewhere else, so I won't go into any more detail. What I intend to spend our time on now is a portfolio budget statement. A portfolio consists of several agencies. This particular example I have here is Resources, Energy and Tourism Portfolio. And this is the budget for the Department of Resources. Okay. I have to explain some of the jargon for you here, unfortunately. Agencies receive funds from four different sources. First one is annual appropriations. I don't know how to get rid of it, but see annual services bill 1 and then other services bill 2. There are two annual appropriation bills. The government actually votes on less than 20% of the budget each year. And the way it actually votes and passes legislation is through annual appropriation bills. There are two appropriation bills, 1 and 2. Why? It's a requirement in the Constitution. The Constitution says that, So I'm not quite sure how to get rid of that. What am I doing?
You hit the mouse, Richard, next to Scott.
You can just click on it. Just click on it, yeah. Okay. Right. Oh, thank you. Okay. All right. The distinction between what Appropriation Bill number 1 deals with ordinary annual services of government, Appropriation Bill number 2 deals with other services. What is the distinction? It's a grey area. There have been barneys over what exactly goes into Appropriation Bill number 1 and Appropriation Bill number 2. Departmental appropriation. Departmental expenses are essentially the cost of running agencies. That's an oversimplification, but that's essentially the cost of paying the public servants and what have you. Administered expenses are essentially programs which the government runs. For example, there's an obscure thing called the Bass Strait Freight Equalisation Scheme. That is a program which is funded under Appropriation Bill number 1. Payments to CAC Act bodies, you will strike that. CAC stands for the Commonwealth Companies and Corporations Act. An example of a CAC Act body is the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. The government doesn't give money directly to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. What it does, it gives money to the Department of Broadband, and the Department of Broadband then in turn passes the money on to the ABC. Now, I don't know in this particular case what the CAC Act bodies, but those are the sorts of bodies, the ABC, the SBS and what have you, these are all CAC Act bodies. So these are all classified as total ordinary annual services. Appropriation Bill number 2, you'll find that many of the expenses under Appropriation Bill number 2, these are payments to basically help the in the form of payments to allow the department to buy new computers or something like that. But it also does include some payments to the states, but most of the payments to the states are no longer paid under Appropriation Bill number 2. So you can see here that we've got the total of available annual appropriations. Now, just a brief description of the columns here. Estimate of prior year amounts. Remember I said the departmental expenses are essentially the cost of running departments. If an agency does not spend its entire budget for departmental expenses, it can carry it over into the next year. So in this particular case, the department has carried over, looks like almost $23 million in funds which it actually hasn't spent, and therefore is available for spending in the following year. Remember I said there are four sources of funds, annual appropriations. The second category is special appropriations. Special appropriations account for more than 80% of government expenditure. This is not voted on each year. Special appropriations are various acts of Parliament which allow the government to spend money. An example is old age pensions. Once you reach a certain age, you're entitled to receive an old age pension if you meet certain criteria and so on and so forth. So the government actually pays age pensions under these various acts, which are called special appropriations. You can see the names of the acts in this particular case that the Department of Resources pays for special appropriations. But some agencies like FACSIA, for example, 99% of the expenditure takes the form of special appropriations because of things such as AIDS pension, disability pension, and so on and so forth. And you can see there you've got the total of special appropriations. Next thing is special accounts. Special accounts in many ways are a pain in the butt, but what they are is if an agency has a particular activity, all expenditure and revenue related to that activity passes through a special account. So some of the funding for particular activities comes from special accounts. The money from the special accounts comes from the appropriation bills, also comes from the special appropriations. So what they do is that if you included the money that was in special accounts as well as the money which is appropriated from annual appropriations and special appropriations into special accounts, you'd end up with double counting. So what they do is right at the end, they deduct the amount that is paid to special accounts, so you end up with this figure here, which is the budget. So if anybody asks you what is the budget of the Department of Resources, this is where you need to go. You can see it's right down here at the bottom, okay, because that encompasses all the funds that that particular agency will receive. What I haven't said is that in the portfolio budget statements, government expenditure is classified by outcomes. The Department of Health, for example, has 11 outcomes. This is an easy, simple one because the Department of Resources has only one outcome. Various programs contribute to outcomes. Okay? In this particular case, there are four programs, and you can see how it's broken down. This is this particular one. You see program four. Oh, I haven't got it here, but program three, program two. You'll see the contribution of each particular source of funding to each particular program and how that contributes to the outcome. So I think that's probably all I need to say or should say at this particular point. If you have any queries about the budget, can I put in two plugs? First, if you have a query about a particular topic, for example, health, if you do not know who the health expert is in the library, please telephone 2500, which is the library's central inquiry point, and they will put you onto the appropriate person. But if you've got any broader questions about the budget, particularly in fiscal policy, you can contact any of us. And so at this stage, I'll leave it open to questions if anybody has something, any questions they want to ask. Okay, these are the contacts here.
Richard, you mentioned that departmental budgets roll over unused funds.
Departmental expenses, yes. There is a process whereby, in effect, the agency can borrow from future years. It doesn't happen often, but there is a process, yes, for doing that. One thing I should have mentioned, so many things I could mention, but later in the year, this is all related to the budget. What happens later in the year? Agencies inevitably find they need more money, so you again go through another process. Called additional appropriations, and they usually come in about November. And it's that particular time agencies go to the government, cap in hand, saying, we want more money for this. And that's usually the main mechanism. If agencies find they don't have enough money, they go to the budget, they go to the government later in the year. Yep.
Questions? Just on that, is there a process that's followed in that application for more funding?
Yes. I remember I mentioned appropriation bills 1 and 2. Later in the year, the government introduces appropriation bills 3 and 4. Appropriation bill number 3 is also for ordinary annual services like appropriation bill number 1. Appropriation bill number 4 is for other services, the equivalent of appropriation bill number 2. So, yes, the government actually has to introduce additional legislation because every cent that the government spends has to be authorised by legislation. The process is called additional estimates. I'm sorry. Yeah.
On that, so in terms of the accounting for the money that gets spent in additional estimates, or that gets appropriated during bills 3 and 4, is that estimated in the forward estimates?
No. One thing I didn't mention is that later in the year, when the government introduces additional estimates, it produces something called the Mid-Year Economic and Fiscal Outlook, the MIEFO. Basically, what the MIEFO is an update of the budget. So it includes all additional measures that the government has introduced since the budget and will include any estimated additional funding through appropriation bills 3 and 4. Yes.
Can I just also mention as well, it is possible sometimes to have additional updates throughout the year. For example, during 2009, early part of 2009, we had an updated economic and fiscal outlook. So that was revising the budget only after they had done a mid-year economic and fiscal outlook, I think in November in 2008. So there can be circumstances under which the budget can be revised more frequently.
Forecasts were out by a considerable margin?
Yeah, basically that the forecasts they had didn't materialise, and so therefore all of their projections about the budget balance, debt accumulation, all just essentially went out the window. All of that stuff was pretty much out of date almost as soon as it was printed. Just because things were evolving so rapidly and people couldn't get a handle on, you know, how bad the downturn was going to be, both globally and domestically here as well. So, but yeah, that definitely has an impact. And so, I should have made that point as well, but the budget papers are almost out of date as soon as they're printed.
One thing I should point out too, whilst there are appropriation bills 3 and 4, in past years governments have introduced up to 8 appropriation bills. So it really depends. If the government feels it needs more money, it has to go to the Parliament, and the format and the way it does it is through additional appropriation bills. But special appropriation, just to emphasise, they just go on forever. They continue to pay, you know, old age pensions, disability pensions, youth allowance, so on and so forth, until the government decides, are we going to change? Are we going to change the, you know, the criteria for accessing these pensions or whatever the case may be? The government, the budget, is mostly estimates of what the government thinks it's going to spend. There are actually very few hard figures in the budget, as Scott emphasised before. Well, the only thing I can say is that, look, it's agencies try to do their best to estimate, because that's what they're doing, they're estimating. And by definition, estimates are estimates, and, you know, they get them wrong. You know, sometimes they get them horribly wrong. And, I really can't speak for agencies, but, you know, they obviously have great difficulty in estimating what the figures are. And as I said before, traditionally what agencies have done in the past is that the further out you go, then the worse their estimates. That's why the Department of Finance has this thing called the contingency reserve, adds in a bit of extra funding, which it knows, because on past experience, it knows are underestimated. Yes, that's right. Yes, yeah.
Would you expect there'd be some government influence from both sides of Parliament on that one?
Probably not, because this is all done within agencies. Because the Department of Faxia, for example, they would be asked to estimate how much do you think you're going to spend on disability pensions this year, and so they'll come up with some sums, and these are the figures that will be put slotted into the budget. So it's really up to individual agencies. I don't know that there's any much ministerial influence or governmental influence over the amounts of the estimates as such. You know, the government influence really comes through in the total amounts it wants to spend, or the decisions as to how much it wants to spend. And, you know, that can be either through payments through appropriation acts or by amending the special appropriations themselves. You know, for example, the government might decide to make it easier to access old age pensions, in which case, obviously, the agency will have to revise the estimates.
Are there any questions?
No? Scott, I think you were saying before that
Well, Treasury do some, they have done in the last couple of years some estimates of how sensitive the revenue side of the budget is and whether their expectations are sort of being met. So there is an analysis in the budget papers on the revenue side. The expenditure side is a little bit harder because with the bulk of the revenue side, it is very cyclical, so it moves with the economic cycle. With a lot of your expenditure flows, a lot of them aren't really, things like unemployment benefits and that sort of thing are cyclically related, but there's large chunks, say defence expenditure, which you would say is not really related to the economic cycle.
And so forecasting the expenditure side is probably quite a lot harder. So the government do put out some estimates of the sensitivity of their revenue estimates, but they don't do anything for the expenditure side, as far as I'm aware. Is that right, Garth? I'm pretty sure they don't do any analysis of the expenditure side. All we can really do is go and look at past data, and I have actually collected figures before on, I think you'll remember I was talking about policy decisions versus parameter and other variations. You can add up the parameter and other variations over time, so a particular budget year might first appear as the fourth year in the budget, and then the next year it becomes the third and the second and so forth. So if you add up or you accumulate the parameter and other variations over time, you can get a rough idea of, you know, whether the budget has been consistently overestimating or consistently underestimating. There may be some particular reasons why the government wants to actually not rely on those variations, but use it in a way to their advantage. So if they're expecting a whole heap of revenue into the future, they may want to temper expectations in the community in the budget, and so they may not actually forecast or project that the revenue is going to grow as strongly as, say, Treasury or the government might think. It could be, yeah, but that's a bit of speculation on my part. So.
Any questions?
Can I just put in one last plug, please? I've written a paper on the budget process, all 82 pages. Try reading it before you telephone us. It appears on the library website. It's the URL is listed on the back of this particular document. But hopefully that might answer some of your questions before you get to us.
Yeah. Before we close on Richard's paper, you can actually use it as a reference source. You don't have to sit down and read 80-odd pages and then get it. It's got a good index on the front, and if you have it handy, if you are concerned about a particular topic, you can simply go to that, look up that topic, and you should be able to find it quite easily. So it's a good reference article.
I have a question, sorry.
Yep. Operation Sunlight is still going on. There have been some major changes to the budget papers, particularly the presentation of the portfolio budget statements. For example, in previous budgets, you didn't actually have the forward year's estimates of each program, but now you do. One change that there will affect this year's budget, under accrual budgeting, the government has given agencies money for depreciation. Depreciation, of course, is the running down of assets. And what has happened in the past is that the government has given money to agencies for depreciation, even though they won't actually use that money until many years hence, when they replace the assets. So people ask, well, why is the government giving agencies money when they don't need it now? So in this forthcoming budget, for the very first time, there will be no funding for depreciation. The way it will operate is that the government will provide capital funding for the agencies for the amount of money that it will need to replace assets. That's one change. Yeah. This forthcoming budget. So agencies obviously will still continue to incur depreciation, but the way depreciation is funded will change. Yep.
Okay. All right.
It's all pretty much. Seeking matrix are as difficult as forecasting expenditure.
Okay.
Was that a copy of your 85-page paper?
Yes, you're welcome to it. Yeah. As I said, stick to budget paper number 4.
Well, next year.
That'll save you a lot of reading. So hopefully, you know, what I've tried to do is
cover everything that you would need to know
about the budget and your web line information.
Or if you can't find them, just contact the central inquiry point and someone can help you. We'll help you find them.
All those sort of things. So hopefully it's designed to be comprehensive.
I've got a lot to do with the Western Australian state budget. I've got to think that the deputy chair of the Public Accounts Committee for a number of years. In all honesty, having read through previous federal budgets, the state budget probably is a more user-friendly version, I think, in Western Australia.
With the exception of Victoria, they haven't changed the format. The total lack of information is the real thing that really strikes.
Yep. Apart from our loss of paper,
did you
read
that? What happened?
I don't know where they are.
No.
It's easy,
but anyway.
And it's quite good. It's the issue with this is it's so broad, right? I mean, it's high level stuff, program level budgeting is difficult when you're going to get it.
But actually, that's what they are saying. Because one of the main questions we get is how much is the government spending in the past 7 or 7 years?